You're listening to The Leonard LoPage Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Rosalind Carter has worked in support of the mentally ill and their caregivers since 1966, when her husband Jimmy was campaigning to become governor of Georgia. She was on this show in May to discuss her latest book, Within Our Reach, in which she laments the current state of our country's mental health care system and describes some of the innovative programs that have been developed to improve mental health services. We got a lot of responses from our listeners about the segment, and we thought we would re-air it for you again today. I began our conversation by describing a moving story in the book's introduction about a woman who was finishing her overnight shift at 4:30 a.m. when Rosalind Carter met her at a cotton mill outside Atlanta. Mrs. Carter said that the encounter set her on her lifelong crusade to help the mentally ill, and I asked her, what was it about that woman that inspired you so?
Well, this was 1966. In 1963, the Community Mental Health Centers Act was passed. And when I started campaigning for Jimmy, people were being moved out of the big central institution into community centers, into the community, and no community centers had been built. And almost daily, someone would ask me what my husband would do for a loved one at Central State who was coming home and no services.
Well, there was a problem. Some of those institutions were deemed to be inhumane, and then it was also felt that people were being kept there sometimes against their will. We were caught in some kind of a bind. We just were not prepared, even though we had that three-year window of opportunity to change things.
Well, funding doesn't always go with the legislation. And this was happening all over the country. The big institutions were being exposés. And people were moving them out. Mm-hmm. It was terrible condition.
And a lot of them just wound up on the streets or with their families and not always under the best of circumstances or in prisons.
Well, today, the prisons and jails and prisons have replaced those big old institutions. I wrote in my book, somebody said that we re-institutionalize. But when I started working, they were being moved out, and they not only put them in against their will, they put them in the state hospitals and left them there. And a few years back, at our Central State, which is still in existence, still has people there, they're about to move them out because they're under court order, but found a hospital just lucked up because it was all grown up with 30,000 graves of people who had been there and died, and nobody had claimed them.
Did you ever learn the name of the woman who got you started on this?
No, because I just met her handing out brochures at a cotton mill, and then, I went on somewhere else and never got in touch with her.
So she has no idea that she set you on this path. And then after Jimmy was elected president, you became the honorary chair of the Commission on Mental Health, helped bring about passage of the Mental Health Systems Act in 1980, played a role in the passage of the Mental Health Parity and Addiction Equity Act of 2008, and yet the problem persists.
That's right. And I am frustrated and even angry about it. And that's why I wrote my book, because I want people to know what I know so we can get over the stigma which holds back almost everything we try to do. So, and get on with doing what's good and right for people with mental illness.
So is it the stigma that's the problem? Because we have passed all this legislation, you'd think that the situation would have improved.
Well, we just passed parity last year, and we're just now getting the rules for implementing it, and this was just passed this year. I think these having insurance might help with stigma. But stigma is so strong, and it keeps people from wanting to give money to a mental health programs because of stigma. It curtails funds from the public and from foundations and from officials. reinstitutionalizing people in the hospitals and the jails and the prisons. The jails and prisons are the largest mental hospitals in the United States. Los Angeles County Jail is the largest one in the United States.
Now, what about the health care bill that just passed? Does that address any of these problems?
It has some good things. Mental health and substance use disorders are in the basic health care package for people, which is really, really, I mean, something we've been trying to get health care, primary health care, medical and surgical and mental health together for years. And so that's a really good thing. No pre-existing conditions, insurance companies.
Which has been a major stumbling block over the years.
That's right. And if groups 50 or plus, like employers, have insurance, if they still don't have to provide insurance, which is, the bill's not perfect. It goes back to the parity bill, which if they provide mental health service, it has to be equal to that of medical and surgical.
Now, were you consulted at all by President Obama or by Congress when they were putting the package together?
I have a really good mental health program at the Carter Center. I had a governor's commission, then a president's commission, and now I have a great program. And I work constantly, I have all these years since we left the White House, with Congress. I worked with Ted Kennedy and Pete Domenici in the Senate and
no longer in the Senate.
No longer in the Senate. And Patrick Kennedy and Jim Randstad, a congressman, Republican congressman, in the House. And I stayed in touch with them all the time, and they let me know if I should come to Washington to testify before Congress. I've been. I went often on working on parity. And so I have contacts. Patrick Kennedy is leaving. The two senators are gone, but I still have contacts from the staffs that are there, that my mental health program stays in touch with all the time.
My guest is Rosalind Carter. Her latest book, this is your fifth, I think, written with Susan K. Gollant and Catherine E. Cade, is called Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Care Crisis. It's published by Rodale. Whatever happened to those community treatment programs? Were any of them instituted? Are any of them doing well?
At the time, there were about half of them. There was supposed to be one within reach of anybody in the country that needed help. And they never did build but maybe half of them. There's still some, but there's a terrible lack. There are good services in some places, but 60%, this is an amazing statistic to me, 60% of the people with mental illness don't get any help. It's not all because of lack of community mental health centers, but some, because of stigma, don't go for help because they don't want to be labeled mentally ill. And some go because they can't afford it. Some can't afford to go. And then
and some
the lack of
treatment.
Trained physicians.
But there also resist. There are people who resist treatment.
I've
been a witness to that.
Yeah.
Somebody who just refused to take medicine, refused to go to doctor's appointments, mm-hmm. and ended up killing himself.
Mm-hmm. Suicide, depression is a great risk for suicide. And did you know that 100 people commit suicide every day in our country? 9 or 10 children every day. And if we had good care and had treatment, today people can recover. And if we could, you know, if they had the services, it's a failure of the mental health system.
Now, we often talk about how drug laws have filled our prisons. Do we have any idea what percentage of the people in our prisons are mentally ill?
I don't have the specific statistics just in my head, off the top of my head. I would say at least a third and maybe more.
Do you think that there are, do we know whether they're being locked up because there are no alternative ways of receiving proper treatment or because they commit crimes and society has no other way of dealing with them?
Well, there's some good things going on in the mental health community. For instance, it's not unusual for a homeless person to get hungry, go into a restaurant, and get up and leave without paying for his food. Some really bad crimes. One point I might want to make to you, though, before I go any further, is that mental ill people are more likely to be victims of crime than to be perpetrators. And mental ill people are victimized 4 times more than the general public.
Mm-hmm.
But now that there are programs across the country started by law enforcement mainly to teach law enforcement people to recognize mental illnesses and take them to a mental health facility instead of to prison. And some of those are going on in the country, which is really good.
What are called jail diversion programs?
Yes.
You've said that a few times. You've seen the criminal justice system treat mentally ill people with compassion and respect, especially in a mental illness court in Albany, Georgia.
That's right.
How does that court differ from other courts?
Well, there are mental health courts springing up in different places, probably not enough of them, but to keep people from going to be put into prison. Albany has a doctor or a nurse or somebody at the prison who can recognize mental illness, and they check the prisoners coming in. And if they have a mental illness, they send them to a mental health court rather another court. I visited one in Albany, Georgia.
So if somebody commits a crime, mm-hmm. well, let's say disturbing the peace or some other petty crime, mm-hmm. or that person may not go to jail. They may wind up being given some other kind of treatment.
Yes.
So how did this develop in Albany, Georgia, and of all places? And are there other courts like this around the country?
There are mental health courts in some places around the country. Not enough. I know I've been trying to get a few more in Georgia. We have several. It's the most wonderful thing. I went to one. The judge said it was not a formal, big, empty, big courtroom. It was a smaller one, but it was a courtroom, set up like a courtroom. And the judge told me that he was not too formal, but he didn't like to be too informal. Well, the first woman came in, and he said to her, "Well, good morning. You're looking wonderful today. How are you doing?" And she said, "I'm doing just great. I got my children back." She had been there. They take them for a year and work with them. And they live at home, but they come in occasionally, and then they have, like, social workers or somebody that work with them. And so he said, "You're doing really well, and if you come in next time and you're still going to your job every day and working, taking care of your children like you've been doing, then you won't have to come back anymore." And this judge was so, and that's unusual in a courtroom. And there was this boy, 16, and he said, "Now, this young man was not supposed to be in my court because he was a young man who his incidents contained a gun. He had a gun, and he's not eligible for the mental health court." He said, "But this was a young boy, 16 years old. He had mental illness. They taunted him at school. He got really upset one day, went out somewhere and got a gun and came back. It was wrestled out of his hands before it went off, but it fired." And so he said, "I told them, I heard his story, and I told them, do not put him in prison. He'll be worse off when he comes out than he is before he goes in. He needs some help." But he was not eligible to give it to him. So he just got in touch with the social worker and others and to check on him. And he came, and every once in a while he goes in and just reports back to him. But, you know, that is so needed, and that's the way all of them should be taken care of. Mm-hmm. It just breaks my heart to see the juvenile justice system in Georgia. We had, a few years back, we had 2 young people who committed suicide, 12 years old. They were in prison for a year. You know how long a year is for a 12-year-old child?
A little bit of understanding can go a long way. Rosalynn Carter's latest book, written with Susan K. Gallant and Catherine E. Cade, is Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Crisis. It's published by Rodale. We'll continue our conversation after this.
We're back with an interview I did with Rosalind Carter in May. She was here to discuss her book, Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Crisis, and we're rebroadcasting it for you today on this long holiday weekend. I asked her if there isn't much more hope today for people who suffer from mental illness than there was just a decade ago.
Absolutely. So many good things are happening. We have new, because of research and the new knowledge of the brain, we have new medications, new treatments, and today people can recover, even from major illnesses when they've been out of it for a long time. Recovery is possible. What we need to start doing is, the most important thing to do is get children and watch them carefully. And
well, a disproportionate number of the people in prison are young, aren't they? I mean, who are mentally ill?
I don't think they're disproportionately young. There are a lot of young ones in there who are in because of drug charges. That's lack of treatment. That's lack of treatment for substance use disorders.
Well, you talked about stigma. One in four people are affected by mental illness each year. Currently the leading cause of disability in the United States, Canada, and Western Europe. Why do you think the stigma continues, since it is so common and probably most people have seen it very close up, either in themselves or in a family member or friend?
I think there are a good many things that contribute to it. One is the fact that they used to be put in the institutions and nobody thought they ever could think straight and so they were just put away and terribly mistreated. But the main issue I think after working in the field so long is the fear factor. People are afraid, and the media doesn't help that. The media is improving, but there's still, there're not as many stories, but still the majority of the stories are negative. And when incidents happen, like Virginia Tech, for instance, if you look at those incidents, almost without exception, it's the mental health system that failed them. Because this young man had been referred to treatment. There was no follow-up. Even people who think they don't have any stigma or feelings against it, when something like that happens, you know, it just says, well, you know, something could happen. We need more good stories about people, because I know we were talking about one poll where people said they didn't want to work by somebody with a mental illness. They're probably sitting next door to somebody who's mentally ill.
Well, you've established a program that offers year-long fellowships to journalists interested in writing about mental health. I guess that's one way of changing the situation. Mm-hmm.
We've been working in a mental health program at the Carter Center to try to overcome stigma for years, different initiatives. And one day we were sitting around and somebody said, why don't we educate some of the media? They have such an impact on how people feel about mental illnesses and people with mental illness. So we began that, and I think last year was our 10th year. We've had over 100, 108, I think, before this year's. You apply for the fellowship with a subject, and we get lots of applications. And they come to the Carter Center and talk about what they're going to do. They don't leave their job. And they come back at the end of the year and report on what they have done. It's been a really good program. And the status of our journalists, I have a lot of, I've had a good many NPR journalists. Washington Post and Los Angeles Times and Newsweek, and just really, really good ones that have come.
Well, it's not just journalists. You may have to try to get people who write TV movies and Hollywood movies, because characters with mental illness are 10 times more violent than other characters on TV shows, mm-hmm. 10 to 20 times more violent than actual people with mental illness. I was shocked to read in your book that people diagnosed with mental illness die on an average 25 years earlier than the rest of us, not from suicides, but from run-of-the-mill ailments like high blood pressure or diabetes that have gone untreated.
they don't go for help. And if they have a heart problem, it continues to get worse. If they have diabetes and then get treated, it gets worse. And right now in my state, I have a Rosalind Carter chair in the school, in the public health school at Emory University. And he's working in the clinic and seeing how the programs, how they affect the people that come. And he's also working with those to try to get people into the clinic.
And it's not just the people who suffer, but the caregivers. In 1987, the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving was established in your honor at your alma mater, Georgia Southwestern State University in Americus, Georgia. Have you focused on helping people who care for the mentally ill? Because it can be a real problem.
Well, when we came home from the White House, Georgia Southwestern State Institution, which is in our county seat, 10 miles from Plains, had a small endowment for a mental health program. And I had worked on mental health, so they asked me to do something with them. And we got home in 81. And it was 87 before I decided that I might have time to do that, because we were establishing the Carter Center, and I was writing a book and different things. But by then, I had a really good program at the Carter Center. So we began with the idea with people caring for those with mental illnesses. Before the first meeting, it spread to include caregivers for physically handicapped, lame, elderly, so we consider all consumers, but we do all our caregivers, but we do work with them, and one of the main things we have to let people who are caregivers know is that they have to take care of themselves. So many people get so caught up in caring for another one, feel so guilty if they leave them even for a minute, that it's really important, because the caregivers, if the caregiver's health is affected, they're less capable of taking care of a loved one.
Was that a concern when in your life, when your father died of leukemia when you were 13 years old, and you helped your mother support the family by taking in sewing and caring for your younger siblings?
It was perfect for me, because I'd worked on mental health and seen so many people struggling to take care of a loved one with mental illness. But it also was something I knew personally, because I was the oldest. I was a girl. I had two brothers and a little sister. I was 13 when my daddy died. My little sister was 4 with two brothers in between. And so my assignment mainly was to take care of the little children and also to help mother with my father. And but mainly to just, you know, take the children out and care for them. But I saw my mother go through that, and the year after my daddy died, my mother's mother died unexpectedly. Mother's the only child. So Papa came to live with us. He was 70 and lived to be 95 and spent the last 4 years of his life in bed. And so I know caregiving, and I know the stress it is, and I know how hard it is to try to take time for yourself, but caregivers have to do that.
My guest is Rosalind Carter, whose latest book is Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Care Crisis. I keep on saying care, and mental health crisis. It's published by Rodale. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. You've been credited with helping to mold the institution of the First Lady into its modern form. Were you concerned earlier the ideal seemed to be the wife who stood by but didn't say anything, didn't take any political positions, mm-hmm. Mamie Eisenhower, Lady Bird, mm-hmm. They were all just seen as the supportive political wives.
Mm-hmm. Well, Lady Bird did beautify Washington and had roadside programs, and she was a great first lady. Well, I campaigned all over the country for a year when Jimmy was running for president. I knew the issues. And I had talked to everybody, and I told them what my husband was going to do. So I needed to know, and He said that every time he got off the elevator upstairs at the, we live on the second floor in the White, I was there to say, why did you do this? Why did you do this? So one day he said, why don't you come to cabinet meetings and you will understand? So I went to the cabinet meetings. And the cabinet members are not the only ones there because they have their assistants sitting around behind them that they can refer to when things come up. So I sat, I just sat right inside the door and was there most every time they met.
It was like monitoring a class.
And then we would sit on the Truman balcony in late afternoon and talk about what we did, and I could ask Jimmy, why are you doing this, and tell him how I felt about what they were doing. I didn't comment in the cabinet meetings, but I did. I had my opinions, and I always told him how I felt. I didn't make public statements about it. But and I worked hard on issues, on mental health and on women's issues and issues of the elderly. But I felt like a partner.
Well, many people had say in retrospect they wished that FDR had listened to Eleanor more than he did. You were the second First Lady to appear before Congress, Eleanor being the first. In your autobiography, First Lady from Plains, which was published in 1984, you recall that you were terribly shy as a young woman. So how did what led to this change?
I don't know. I think doing the things I had to do, for instance, when we got married, but the first a couple of years, Jimmy was on battleships 4 days a week, on a battleship 4 days a week, and home on weekends. I had to take care of everything while he was gone, and I gained some independence, I think.
Well, do you remember how long it was before you stopped breaking out in hives when you were asked to speak on his behalf?
It took me a long time to get. So I didn't think I could make a speech. And one day I was sitting at a luncheon, and they introduced me and said that I was to speak to them. And I have no idea now what I said. But I used to go in the ladies' room before I went on and memorize what I had said and try to. And that's so hard. One day when Jim was governor, I was leading tours through the governor's mansion and going into the rooms and talking to people. And he said, why don't you put your speech down and just talk to them like you do when you're talking on a tour, which I did. And I remember leaving that meeting and running to the telephone and calling Jim and say, I did it. That was an exciting time for me.
Well, yeah. Do you get used to having the Secret Service accompany you everywhere? There are two Secret Service people here.
I've had security since 1971, except for Jimmy was, term as governor was up in January, and they were assigned to us in October when he was a candidate. That's the only time I haven't had him. And in the beginning, it was so hard. The worst thing was not being able to just go out and get in the car and go somewhere. When Jim was elected governor, I couldn't do that. And one day I said, I have to go drive somewhere. He said he would tell the, there was state patrol, but he had sent him to Secret Service school in Washington. And he said, I'll tell them just to turn the radio so that you can call them if you have any problem and let you go. I went down, he'd forgotten to tell them. And I said, I am going. And so they fixed the radio and showed me how to use it. And I drove 60 miles north of Atlanta to the home of a friend. And I got there and knocked on the door, and she came to the door. And I was crying. I said, I came all the way by myself. but you get used to it, and they're really, really helpful.
You were featured in a Wall Street Journal story in February about long marriages, and in it you were quoted as advising women, never write a book with your husband. What happened when you and Jimmy tried to write a book together?
It was the worst experience. It was the nearest we ever came to a divorce, I think. We have such different writing habits. He can go in his office. We were going to write this book about making the most of the rest of your life. And we had all kinds of stories. And we did it because we had a conference at the Carter Center on eating right and exercising, and we were going to make the points in the book. And he can go in his office. He was going to write one chapter, and I was going to write one chapter. And then we'd go in and share them. He could write in an afternoon. It'd take me a couple of weeks. He said that I considered his a draft and that mine was like Moses going up on Mount Sinai and coming back with the Ten Commandments and not one word could be changed. And he was absolutely right. I felt that way about mine. But we couldn't even talk about it. We wrote ugly things to each other on the computer. And I would never, ever again write a book with him.
Well, you are about to celebrate your 65th wedding anniversary.
64.
Pretty impressive. The subtitle of the book, which I will read correctly this time, is Ending the Mental Health Crisis. Do you think we can actually end it?
I think we could end it if we can develop the political will. But so much good is happening now with the Parity Bill and the new health care bill. With all that we know about the brain, we know what to do, and we don't do it.
Well, you just have to convince the Tea Party members that this is all for the best.
Well, but the recovery movement is the most important thing. It's the most important development in all these years I've been working. And it was the consumers that did it. The consumers are those living with a mental illness. And they had such really bad experiences with mental health system, some of them, and so they started a consumer network and began talking with each other about their problems. And what people with mental illness need is respect, for people to think that, you know, that they're good citizens in the community, and most of them are. We just hear about the ones that have problems. And housing is important for them, employment is important for them. And when they got together, they started. Georgia now has certified peer specialists. They are consumers, people living with mental illness, who are looking out for people who need help, like on the streets, and just kind of gathering them in. We have a consumer network. We need that all over the country, and it's beginning to happen in some states.
Rosalind Carter's book, written with Susan K. Gollant and Catherine E. Cade, is Within Our Reach, Ending the Mental Health Crisis. It's published by Rodale Press. Thank you so much for being with us.
I enjoyed it.